Mr. Parnaby, Reel 2. We're talking about the Territorial Army. Do you remember what the payment was that you received?
I couldn't tell you the exact payment. No, I'm afraid not. The exact wages.
What the bounty? You got a bounty once.
A bounty, and that's another thing. It was quite a lump sum.
And you did mention the attraction, or one of the attractions for joining the TA was the money, obviously, and the fact that you got away for a fortnight.
Yeah, yes.
Which you never had opportunity of.
No. And on weekends, you went away on weekends, those. Yes.
The drill hall, can you describe it to me?
What? Bottom of Dykeland's Road, large drill hall with officers on one side. Through the door, like in offices, and the officers' mess was up above there, and the sergeant's mess was up above on the bottom end, the corporal's and the men's mess was underneath, but there was the big hall for training purposes, and there were stores up the other side, quartermaster stores, and then outside there was the square and the garages for the vehicles.
What vehicles did you have in 1938?
In 1938, there was Lister generators, and then there was Guy lorries and TSMs, Till and Stevens motors. And they were petrol electrics. There was no gearbox on them. It was an engine and a motor, a dynamo than a generator. And then you had a motor and the prop shaft of the back axles, and that connection would be two wires, but was controlled under the steering column. First one you put in, that made the connection. The second one was the voltage. But after you set that, you just drove normally. Your engine speeded up the motor, the dynamo rather. That's like you could say the clutch and the gearbox. See, of course, when you opened the throttle and the engine revved up fast, so the dynamo went fast, so the motor went faster, so your wagon went faster. Oh, they were a nice thing. But when you got to the site, you disconnected the controls, the electrical switches, turned them right round, and that generator went along a 500-yard cable to the searchlight.
Same generator from the vehicle to the searchlight.
Yes, it cut out. It wouldn't move. It cut out the movement of the vehicle, but the current went along the cable.
Well, we'll come to talk about the searchlight in a few minutes.
Uh-huh.
Who was commanding this unit?
Colonel Iliff.
It was a 386. Did you say?
386.
Searchlight Regiment, presumably.
Yes.
His full title.
Yes, yeah. It was Major Iliff at the time, but he went up to colonel.
And what was he like as a man?
Oh, he was
an officer.
He was a gentleman. He lived at Whitburn. He did. He was a gentleman. And his second in command was then Captain Dixon. He went up to Major Dixon and took over when Colonel Iliff, whether he was promoted and went elsewhere or retired, but Major Dixon, and he was a gentleman as well.
And he was 2IC, you say?
Yeah.
What was his background, did you know?
Oh, I don't really. I think they were only solicitors. And
they were all seen to be professional men.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
How was the unit organised? You've got your colonel and your 2IC. What was the organisation coming down?
You had a quartermaster. He was a regular soldier. The quartermaster. And then you had the adjutant, regular soldier. And then you had captains, and lieutenants, and second lieutenants, tier, in the unit. Of course, you had the RSM, regular soldier. And then you had your BSMs, battery sergeant majors, staff sergeants, sergeants. There was one or two lance sergeants, but I think that rank's gone. And then there was the bombardiers and lance bombardiers, and then gunners.
How was the regiment, this particular searchlight regiment, split up into its various parts?
Well, we're dealing with 386. There was 386, 87, 88, and 89. Those were the four batteries in the regiment. Now, each battery had four troops, and each troop had six detachments, making 24 searchlights in the battery. Hence why in the regiment, of course, with the four batteries, you'd have 96 searchlights all told. But in this, the one battery, you had four troops, six detachments each, 10 men to one detachment. 10 men made up of the detachment commander, two stripes, corporal or bombardier. He was number one. Number two and number three were spotters. Number four was on the long arm of the searchlight. Number five was the searchlight operator, switch and everything. Number six was the lance corporal. He was on the sight of the sound locator. Seven and eight was the sound locator. Number nine was the generator hand. Number ten, cook. That's your 10 men in the detachment.
And they would be different sites, presumably.
Oh, yes. Each of them was on different sites, all scattered around.
Where were the sites when you joined?
Well, I was at troop headquarters, you see. In each one, the troop, each one of them detachments, there was one detachment which was troop headquarters. Well, I was not a detachment operator, though I could do it. You learn them sort of things. I was at troop headquarters as a troop fitter. And we were stationed troop headquarters at Nunick, about 2.5 miles outside of Ripon. And of course there you had, myself, the troop fitter, a dispatch rider, a batman, and a medical orderly. That's our batman. Those were the extras.
And who commanded a troop?
A second lieutenant. We had two, addressed as Mr. Because I had one pip.
Now, you did mention at this point, you did mention that it was Royal Engineers and not DLI.
Right. At first it was Royal Engineers that was running the searchlights, the ACAC then. But being ACAC, I think it would be 1940, it came under the Royal Artillery.
Right, we've established that.
Yeah.
Now then, you've got your sections which you've described. Now, can you tell, you've mentioned the various roles that the 10 men played.
Yeah.
Can you describe the searchlight? What exactly its size, shape, whatever?
90 centimetre searchlight. The approximate diameter of the light itself would be about approximately 3 feet. Large reflector at the back. And you had carbons, not an electric bulb. You had two carbons, like that. And whether, you know, up and down or in and out, which could be operated by the searchlight operator outside. If the light was getting altering from a, you know, he could turn wheels and move the carbons and keep them in line, keep the carbons going. But they were worked like a clock, going slowly when the electricity was on. But for some unknown reason, if the gap got too small or too large, it could manually put it right. And there was also a switch on, which he did 30 seconds before switching the light on, a fan. You had the fan going at the top. And you had a proper way to do that, because you have a long arm out here and a switch under there. There's no good going around with your right arm to put the switch on, because if the light jumped, it'd break your arm. So you went round underneath that away. Switched the fan on and took the arm out.
What intensity was the beam, do you know?
Oh.
Well, what kind of distance would it go?
I can only give an approximate. The 90 centimetres, I believe, was about 5 miles.
And these were replaced later, I think you said, with a larger one.
By a large 150s, 120s. Yeah, they were about 6 foot wide, bigger ones. And when you unscrewed them for cleaning purposes, two-man job, well, the long-arm man, the four and five, did that. Just tilted it round and lifted it out. But you always did it with your back to the sun. Because if the sun got into the reflector, it'd blind you. Good. And when it was put down, it had to go face down. And if you wanted to clean it, it had to be lifted with it away from the sun to clean it. Never let the reflector get on the sun. Because it would blind you. And the glare. I mean, it shoots that glare, you know. Why am I? So you can imagine.
And how often were they maintained? Was it a daily task?
Yes, a daily task. Daily task. Were there didn't take long.
Were there any trouble with the carbons that you've already mentioned? Did they?
Oh, they burned away. But of course, he had the box around one, a load of negative and a load of positives, as we call them, negative and positives. The negative ones had flat ends. The positive ones had long flat ends, and the negative ones had tapered. And there was the ones that come up, and that taper should be in the centre for to give it correct. There was a gauge to put on, you know, for to adjust them to, which was their job. I knew this, I mean, I've done it myself, but I wasn't an actual operator.
Yes, I realise this, but I'm using your knowledge of the searchlights at this point in time. So they were regularly maintained and cleaned, and you've described basically what they were. What did they stand on? How were they? Were they rigid?
No, they were on a chassis with the 90 centimetres was on a chassis with four little tracked wheels. They were on tracks. And to get them on the lorry, underneath the lorry you had two ramps which you pulled out, clipped in, and they were sloped. Then you had pulleys with a rope. The hook round to the lamp, round to the centre of the lorry at the back, into the corner, and the rope straight out, and the detachment pulled the rope, walked away with the rope, and the lamp went up the ramp inside. And when it was coming out, they did the same in reverse. Hold the rope to lower it down. Once it was in or out, uncouple the pulleys, the ropes, and stow them. Then, when the lamp was positioned, if your lorry was a generator as well, when the lamp was positioned right, you had your cable, 500 yard cable, down, connected, and you drove the lorry slowly away to the other end. That's where you were out the road of the lamp. The number 9 or the driver. If it's a lorry, he's a driver. But if it's a listed generator, he's a number 9. That's the number in the detachment, number 9. That was him. And he sat there on his own. When he got the alarm, start your engine up. Switches was already in. And as soon as they got the alarm, put a switch in, and the juice was at the current was up at the searchlight before the lads got out the hood. 30 seconds readiness.
Manoeuvring it up, down, sideways, and whatever. Yeah. How was that done?
You mean the lamp itself?
Yeah, the lamp itself.
Well, it goes round and round on a turntable. You see, there's the long arm out.
And someone's pushing that, is that?
Yeah, the number 4. Long arm operator. The steering wheel. But he's about 12 foot away from the lamp. See? He's away from it. So as he can, he's got to be that distance away so as he can see the end of the beam. And if by luck or chance or whatever, illuminates a target, he says, target seen, on. And it's up to him to keep it there. He's got the steering wheel. He can walk round, backwards and forwards, up and down. He can walk round. If he loses it, he'll yell, target lost, and the sound will cater people and start taking on and directing, because he's got the number 6 has headphones to the number 4.
How did that function? The sound detectors. What did they look like, for example?
Obsolete, of course, now, but then there was like 4 trumpets, 3 in a row and 1. And you had the sound locator. That's what there was, the sound locator. And you had the number 6 behind on the sights. The 7 and 8. 7 up and down. 8.
Horizontal.
Perpendicular and horizontal, that's the ones, yes. And they're down, you know, they keep their heads down. They don't look at the searchlight. They're listening. The number six on the searchlight, on the sound locator, the number six, he's looking at the sights and he's speaking. Now, the sound locator men are going round, and when they get that sound, I don't know whether you've noticed, but when you hear an aeroplane, if you put your head down and close your eyes, you can hear it. And if you move your head from side to side like that, the sound of the... You try it sometime, and the sound's going along across your forehead. It's true. That's how the sound locator comes in. Now, they're listening, and when they... Of course, they're using it with the trumpets, you see. When they... Number eight says, on. Number seven says, on. Number six will yell, on, expose. The number five shoves the switch in, the light up, and should illuminate the target. And when he does that, the number four yells, on, and it's up to him then to keep it in the end of the beam. And we weren't in a gun area, we were in a night fighter area.
We'll come to that.
All right.
We'll come to that. So now, where were the communications coming from telling you that, you know, an aircraft was coming or a raid was on? Or was there some line of communication through to the the searchlight?
There was telephone to troop headquarters, but then you had RT to the detachments. RT, radio telephone, but that was for intercommunications. You always had a sentry out at night time. Now troop headquarters gets warning of air raid. Searchlight beam straight up. Marker, and the sentries on the other detachments, and bring them out. Stand to.
That's based on the troop searchlight.
Troop headquarters searchlight, the marker. Until they got through on the RTs, which was time taken. It's quicker to put a beam up and a sentry to see it and bring them out.
Well, obviously it's. It would appear difficult to, once you've got on an aeroplane, to keep it. Because it's obviously lit up and the pilot is trying to get out of the beam.
Yeah.
Is it a difficult task, or is it more difficult for the pilot than it is for the searchlight?
Well, once he's got it up there, like that, there is a lever at the front of the searchlight, which, when he sees on, he can pull that lever over and the beam goes out like that. Dispersed beam.
Did you work on one searchlight on an aircraft, or was there some kind of system of beaming a number onto it?
No, you just worked on one. That's all you could do, work on one. But the night fighters, well, you come into that.
Well, I was just going to say now, obviously, if you got onto an aircraft, then the night fighter comes in. Would it make life difficult for a night fighter to be coming in on an enemy aircraft that's got a big searchlight beam around it?
No. They knew the searchlights, and the searchlight knew they had a target there. Now, if another one comes in, they'd know he was friendly, because he'd be having bang, 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 machine guns, tracers. They'd know which was which. And, of course, we also had what we called the fruit for secrecy. An aeroplane coming over, and a marker beam would go up, you know, and then suddenly you'd see two reds or two greens or two yellows or a red and a green, different colours. It's a friendly.
Well, that was how they if you got into a friendly aircraft.
But you had to be careful. There wasn't any enemy aircraft around, because he could see what they were, and it was changed every day. And he used to get it through on the telephone, the fruit for the deer. The fruit for the deer, two greens, or two yellows, or two reds. A red and a green, a red and a yellow, and this, that and the other. It was changed every day. I mean, if you can hear aircraft, you know, and you expose one searchlight, and straight away, one of them would fire out his fruit signal. And if that tallied with the one of the deer, you'd put the searchlights out. If it didn't tally, then you started performing, get them all on. And of course, as you say, when you have the master searchlight, whoever picks it up, men on other sites can see the little silver dot, and there, an R horn in, and of course then you've got like a corn of searchlights, all on the one thing. And the night fighter up above can see a flashover or a flick over on the clouds, and he knows where he is, because he's up above them. And actually, you know, when you're up there and the searchlight's on, it's dazzling up there, but you can't see the ground. The ground and everything is not lit up. All you see is just a little round. Because we used to say, well, it's all very well, but if it's a Jerry comes over and put the searchlights on, we'll illuminate the whole. No, you're not. No, you're not. It's only a little round
light from the light from the center.
Yeah, from the center. You don't see any of the ground at all.
Can we move back then to the early days now? We've done very well there. What were the initial, or what was initial training was given you when you first joined? And you personally,
marching, as every other soldier learns in the army, you do drills and drill, which covers saluting and
weapon drill. Did you have a rifle?
Yes, you did weapon drill and that. And certain Sundays we were away at the rifle range along at Whitburn, rifle firing practice, and Bren gun.
So you did a basic infantry drill.
Yes, how to handle your gun, a rifle.
Route marches? Did you do that?
No. The only marches we did is if it was Sunday, a church parade, a special one. Another one we did was we were given the freedom of Sunderland, where I could walk around the town with a rifle and a bayonet on my shoulder. You can't know. That's what it means. You've given the freedom of the city, or the freedom of the town then. But that's what we were given, and of course we paraded on the seafront, and the mayor and all that.
What was the civilian attitude towards territorial soldiers before the war, in the peacetime period?
Oh, okay. Didn't have any problems.
They weren't known as weekend soldiers, or?
Well, that's what they were called, weekend soldiers, but they knew what they were for, as we soon found out.
So you're well respected, in effect?
Yes. I'll go so far as to say you weren't disliked. You weren't disliked. But in all
you said that you did this initial training, basic training, and at what point in time then did you get your uniforms? Is that immediate?
Yes. Oh, yes.
What uniform were you issued with?
Battle dress. Tunic, trousers, boots, gaiters, hat, badge. Gas mask. You did gas mask, gas training. You know how to, what to do with your gas mask.
They put you through a gas training process.
Yes.
Was this included going into the hut with the?
We did go into a tear gas. Oh yes, we got that as well, which is obvious.
Shirts and underclothing.
Shirts, vests, pants. That came afterwards, mind. After we'd gone away. The underclothes, shirts we got, but the underclothes came. We weren't issued with them at the drill hall, but they did issue them after we were mobilised and away.
Equipment, what did you get? Packs and belts?
Side pouch, two pouches on the front, water bottle, bayonet frog, your belt and the two straps. To your big pack on the back, which held your overcoat, and your stained helmet on the outside. Yes, that's it.
And you took these home with you, did you, in the initial stages, before the war started, before you moved, and kept them clean, presumably?
Yes.
Were you regularly inspected?
Yes. Oh, yes, you did get inspections. Of course, you didn't use your uniform at drill nights. Your equipment, rather, just your uniform. But you still had gaiters or a belt to keep blancoed and the brasses polished. That's only cleanliness. It's only self-respect. That's why I can't understand a lot of people moan about it. It's just teaching your self-respect, which a lot doesn't have.
Did you have kit inspections?
Yes. While we were away, yes.
This was when you went away, which we'll come to when you go away.
Yes.
But in the drill halls, peacetime situation,
we didn't have them. We didn't have the underclothes and everything like that. These was all issued after we'd gone away. Well, of course you would. It was laid out, actually, on your bed every morning when you got up. Your bed's up, blankets folded, and your kit and your webbing laid out. Your second pair of boots polished. That was the way, and that was it. And, of course, the inspector would come round and see the digs every day.
You said that you'd gone in as a fitter.
Aye, as a mechanic, yes. Engine, mechanic. What do you call it? MT.
Did your training as a fitter start immediately when you joined?
No. I was driver. I was driving and that. But on my credentials, I was a motor mechanic. Courses came afterwards. After we'd gone away, you didn't get them from the drill hall. It was after we went away. I hadn't been away long, but I was away on a 2 months course to Leeds.
Where were you? What you were called up immediately before the 3rd of September, were you not? 2 or 3 days before that you were... brought, you know, called up into the...
13th of August.
Yeah. 13th of August?
We went away, 13th of August.
This was a camp, was it?
Yeah, no. We were going to camp.
Where did you go?
Ripon.
And what kind of things were you doing there at Ripon?
Just what I've been saying, detachment. I went to Ripon, a place down the Boroughbridge Road, which is called, there's a cafe there called Skeldale Cafe. And there's a big wide area at the bottom. I suppose they use it for car park. And that's where the first went. And from there, the detachment split up to where they had to go.
Do you recall which sites they went to?
Yes, the ones I've just stated. We went to Nunick, which was troop headquarters. There was one went behind the Beedale Hunt. On the North Road. There was one went to Nosterfield, Thornborough, Binsow, that's above Tanfield. And Swinton, up above. Swinton, that's right. That was our six.
That covers a wide area.
Yeah, that covered, well, I mean, the searchlight, you know, when the North Stanley, that's the other one. From down below, 5 mile up, see it. Well, then, of course, you've got the other batteries with their six all ringed around as well. That's what I see in 96.
And this was, to all intents and purposes, the being just your normal annual camp?
Yes, that's where it was. Be honest, that was my first one, of course. It was my first.
What are your memories of it? What were you doing?
War broke out. Our annual camp, we went away on August the 13th. And set up station at Nunick and the other sites where they set up. And my job each time was to go around the sites and check on the generators and the wagons, oil, water, diesel. When it comes to the electrical side, my pal, that was his job, he was the troop fitter, electrical. Mine was troop fitter mechanical, he was troop fitter electrical. He'd say to the brushers and the generator commutators on the dynamos and that. That was his job. Well, that was mine. Sunday morning, 3rd of September, was church parade. So went round the sites with a lorry. I had a lorry of my own because I had a traveller. An impressed lorry, not an army lorry then. It was an impressed vehicle. And I went round, brought the surplus men in, down to Ripon, paraded and marched into the church. Not there now. It's on the main road. You know Ripon? And you go down the bank, under the railway bridge, that was, over the river and straight up towards Ripon. On the right-hand side was a church. And that's why we're in there.